The Perfect Weapon is a new HBO documentary based on the best-selling book of the same name by New York Times national security correspondent David Sanger. The film draws on interviews with top military, intelligence, and political officials for a comprehensive view of a world of new vulnerabilities, particularly as fears mount over how cyber attacks and influence operations may affect the 2020 U.S. elections. As news breaks this week about ransomware hitting the nation's hospitals, there are also fears over vulnerable power grids, America's nuclear weapons arsenal, and the global networks that are the backbone of private enterprise. The film also explores how the U.S. government is struggling to defend itself from cyber attacks while simultaneously stockpiling and using the world's most powerful offensive cyber arsenal. David Sanger is a national security correspondent and a senior writer at the New York Times. In a 38-year reporting career for the Times, he has been on three teams that have won Pulitzer Prizes, most recently in 2017 for international reporting. I had a socially distanced conversation with him on the campus of Bennington College on Wednesday night, and it's a great pleasure to welcome David Sanger to the roundtable this morning. David, what a great pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you, Joe. It's great to be back with you. We've done this once or twice before under in previous times, and really great to be here at Bennington, to be at the Brick House, and for me and Cheryl to be back with our wonderful friends, Laura and Bert.
The book came out in 2018. This is released just before the election. At what point did you know that a documentary would come out of the book?
Well, soon after the book came out, the then president of HBO called and told me they'd had a really hard time over the years just trying to figure out how you do a documentary about cyber, because you don't want to have a documentary in which, as our director, great director John Maggio put it, you had a bunch of guys in hoodies leaning over keyboards. And you will not see anybody in a hoodie leaning over keyboards even once in this documentary. So the question was not could we do it, but could we find a way to do it as sort of a thriller, kind of a truly engaging documentary, not a bunch of talking heads sitting around saying, this is a very severe problem. Mm. And I think that what's happened now over time is that as we worked away on it, we found ways to begin to do that. But the hard part was figuring out how to make the whole thing work.
The way you do it is fascinating. It is, you do it chronologically. You begin in 2007. Why was that a good year and a good place to start?
It wasn't as much of the year as the event.
Right.
We begin with what the world came to know as Stuxnet, which was the American cyber attack, American and Israeli cyber attack on Iran's nuclear program. And it was one of the most secret operations the United States has ever run. It was codenamed Olympic Games. And for 3 years, the United States and Israel got code that into the computers that controlled this underground nuclear enrichment site. It's where these giant centrifuges spin at supersonic speeds to produce uranium. And that's, of course, one of the basic fuels for nuclear weapons. No uranium, no bomb. And the reason that they did it was that President Bush had just been through the experience of the invasion of Iraq on the false pretense that they were building a nuclear weapon. Mm-hmm. He said to me on numerous occasions he could never convince anybody that in public that Iran was building a nuclear weapon, even though there wasn't a whole lot of dispute in the country that the Iranians at least had that as an ambition. And so one day a group of generals and intelligence officials came to him and said, sir, we've got another way. And it was trying to use a cyber weapon. Nobody really thought this would work. And so they set up a secretly underground in Tennessee a model of the Natanz nuclear enrichment site and then attacked it with code. And the question was, could they make the centrifuges blow up? And they did. And that began the whole process. But in 2010, the code got out of Natanz by mistake, and it began spreading around the world. And when it spread around the world, we began looking at the structure of the code, and that led me to some of the reporting that was in Confront and Conceal about how the U.S., through two presidents, put this together in the Situation Room, with those presidents basically picking out the locations that would be attacked.
Mm-hmm.
That opened the age of cyber conflict.
One of the things that you talk about in the book, and also, of course, in the documentary, is that that code initially was fascinating because it would go in and then would just kind of lie in wait.
That's right.
And then would attack.
You know, it did more than that, Joe. It did lie in wait. It watched how normal operations happened. And then, like a scene in Ocean's 11, where you may remember that they go into the safe in the casino, but they run a tape back to the control room that shows the normal operation of,
you know, everything is okay here.
Nothing's happening, you know, while it's being cleaned out. That's essentially what the code did. It sent signals back to the control room that said everything's spinning fine until the Iranians started hearing centrifuges exploding underground.
So the two things that the U.S. basically had at this time were the drone program and Olympic Games. Then in 2010, then what happens as far as how the U.S. says, okay, did they know what they had, really?
Well, the U.S. knew exactly what they had, and they knew and met in the Situation Room in the summer of 2010 as the code began to leak out, and they recognized that suddenly the Iranians were going to realize that these centrifuges weren't blowing up because of mistakes they were making or because of scientists that were making mistakes or manufacturing error. It was blowing up because malicious code was being put into it. And in the current context, it's pretty interesting because when you go and reconstruct those meetings, Joe Biden is sitting right there in the midst of it and saying to President Obama, you know, I think the Israelis made a mistake here. They were rushing to get some new code in, and it got out, which appears to be the leading theory about what went wrong. For us, journalistically, it was an interesting moment because a piece of code carries signatures with it just the way a fingerprint or DNA would. You can pick it apart and see where the people who wrote it were trained. They're sort of leaving a signature kind. This code was designed only to attack groups of 164 machines, which I knew from covering the Iranian nuclear program for many years is exactly the way the Iranians organize the centrifuges in their centrifuge halls. In groups of 164. So when we saw that number, we knew right away what this code was intended for.
There's a quote in the documentary, "There are legitimized attacks without declaring war." You also make the point that from, say, 2007, this isn't on the radar at all as a threat. And then by 2012, cyber is the number one threat that is considered, basically.
That's right. In the, if you go back to the 2007 Intelligence Agency's annual report to Congress about threats to the United States, and you go to read the cyber section, it doesn't take a lot of your day. There is no cyber section. In the past 7 or 8 years, it's been the number one threat. And tonight, as we sit here, we have hospitals across America that are being attacked by ransomware in the midst of the COVID treatment crisis. And we actually only became aware of a lot of these attacks today. Now, we don't know how severe they're going to be, whether or not they'll paralyze these hospitals. But that's something we've now learned to live with each and every day. Cyber conflict has escalated. But as you point out, Joe, these are not necessarily acts of war. What's remarkable about the day-to-day cyber conflict is that it's all carefully calibrated, or has been so far, to stay just below that threshold that would require you to have a military response. And part of what we do in the documentary is take you through this escalating series of attacks on the Sony Pictures Entertainment case, on the Sands Casino, against OPM, the Office of Personnel Management, and how each one of the aggressors, North Korea, Iran, China, made sure that while they were escalating, they didn't go over that invisible red line that might trigger a military response. And really, that's part of the problem right now, which is that most countries believe this is a free fire zone. You can do this without really significant consequence. So some of your operators might be exposed or indicted. Mm. You might get some financial sanctions. But basically, it's worth it to take the risk.
The Sands was really the first, right? That began. And was that because Sheldon Adelson was shooting his mouth off, basically?
So the Sands Casino in Las Vegas is, you know, known to anybody who's seen pictures of the Strip or visited there. It's owned by Sheldon Adelson, who was a major conservative donor and a major supporter of Israel. And one day he had been at Yeshiva University in New York and was being interviewed about what he thought the United States should do about Iran's nuclear program. And he said, well, we should just call in the jets. You'll see the video of this in the documentary. It's a rather remarkable moment. And drop a nuclear weapon in the Iranian desert and tell them that the next one will be in Tehran if they don't turn over their nuclear program. Mm. So the Iranians, it turns out, caught this on YouTube. Yeah, you can get YouTube in Iran. And they're thinking, Sheldon Adelson, desert, guy owns a casino.
Right.
Be really a shame if his operators came in one day and flipped on the switches and nothing happened, which is exactly what happened 3 months later. And the casino, while there were rumors of this out there, went to extraordinary lengths to hide what had happened because it was so embarrassing. And when we went to film this years later, we had to go find employees of the Sands who had been forced to sign non-disclosure agreements. And you'll see them in the documentary with their faces obscured and their voices changed, describing what it was like to be there during the attack.
Of course, there's the Sands in Las Vegas, but they initially hit the Sands in, is it Nebraska?
I think they hit one on the East Coast early on. They hit a related facility and used it to tunnel through to get to this. What they really wanted to do was be in Vegas.
Right.
Yeah.
And as you point out in the documentary, in this case, what happens in Vegas didn't stay in Vegas.
Too often it happens that way. What happens in Vegas doesn't stay in Vegas. But yeah, this one certainly didn't. And, you know, today the idea of attacking Sony, which melted down 70% of their computing power, or a casino, almost seems like, you know, single-A ball compared to the scope of some of the cyber operations we've seen since.
There was the attack on Sony. I guess the start of this was the movie The Interview. Seth Rogen is featured in the documentary. North Korea gets upset over the film. As far as Sony goes, they are looking for, yes, they knew what to release, right? As far as there was the Hollywood gossip and then also threats that came with that.
So the Sony story is really a remarkable one because it's one of the first times when geopolitics led to a cyber attack in the United States. It was a bizarre example because it was, as you say, over a Seth Rogen movie. One that I don't think was one of his better movies.
No.
But, you know, we'll set that aside for the moment. And in the documentary, you'll see Seth Rogen describing what this is like. There are very few documentaries I can think of out there that have both Seth Rogen and Hillary Clinton both describing what it was like to be a victim of a cyber attack.
And John Podesta thrown in for good
measure. And John Podesta, that's right. And I keep telling people I'm in a Seth Rogen movie, and they look at me like, yeah, sure. So the interview was a crazy comedy about two journalists who get sent off to interview Kim Jong-un, who was supposed to like their TV show or something. And the CIA hires them to assassinate Kim Jong-un on the way out. And we're thinking of this in, you know, American terms. Oh, gee, isn't that, you know, a funny, crazy Seth Rogen plot? North Koreans look at it, and it's a deep offense. So they write to Sony, and they say, you can't bring this out. And Sony ignores them. And they write to the UN Secretary General and say, you must stop this. And he ignores them. And then they send a couple of hackers to China, Thailand, Malaysia. They spent months working out code to break into Sony. And when they get in there, they figure out where everything is, the emails, the production schedules, the films that are getting ready to be released. They released a few of the emails in sort of an early indication of what the Russians would do later on. This is how we learned the important national security information that some people at the studio thought that Angelina Jolie was extremely difficult to work with on the set. We didn't do much with these emails of the New York Times, but the National Enquirer had a great time with them.
Field day.
Along the way, the hackers then figured out that the real way to wreak revenge on Sony was to melt down their computers. And right around Thanksgiving of 2014, that's exactly what they did.
You make the point in the documentary that that event changed the perception of cyber attacks purely as an attack to destroy.
That's right. It, like Stuxnet, it was out there to do physical harm in the physical world. And this led to a fascinating debate in the Obama White House. There were some military officials who came in and said, Mr. President, this is an act of war. If they had blown up Sony's facilities, we'd be at war with them right now. Obama looked at them and said, act of war? This is a Seth Rogen movie. Turns out, by the way, Obama likes Seth Rogen movies, but you know, who knew? And so he said this is an act of sabotage. I think publicly he said it was an act of vandalism. I think he later came to regret. I know he later came to regret the use of that phrase as sort of taking it too lightly. But the U.S. really didn't know how to respond. In the end, they put some sanctions on North Korea. I mean, I don't think the North Koreans noticed amid all the other sanctions on North Korea. They convinced the Chinese to turn off the internet connection to North Korea for a couple of days around New Year's in 2015. I think the North Koreans probably thought they had forgotten to pay their cable bill. It didn't really make a big difference to North Korea. And that was the beginning of a series of mistakes I think the Obama administration made in underreacting to cyber attacks that ultimately set a signal to Vladimir Putin that he was free to go ahead into the DNC and other attacks because there really is no penalty here.
The president, President Obama, quoted, you have the tape in the documentary where he says, we will respond proportionally.
I don't think we did.
Right.
I don't think we did. I think we did some temporary pinprick operations. And it's interesting because later on we take you to the testimony of Paul Nakasone, the general who now runs U.S. Cyber Command. And at his confirmation hearing, he said quite clearly in response to a question from one senator that our enemies don't fear us on this. And they don't fear us because the North Koreans got away with what they got away with. And Iran got away with what they got away with, and the Chinese got away with what they got away with. So the fundamental deterrence calculation just wasn't working.
David Sanger is our guest. The HBO documentary The Perfect Weapon is playing and streaming now on HBO based on the book The Perfect Weapon, War, Sabotage, and Fear in the Cyber Age. We'll continue our conversation with David Sanger after this short break. Welcome back to the Roundtable. I'm Joe Donahue. David Sanger is our guest, a national security correspondent and a senior writer at The New York Times. His new project is the HBO documentary, The Perfect Weapon.
So you mentioned Russia. So Russia at this point is lurking, right? They're watching this and they're lurking. Why the DNC?
Because it was unguarded, very easy to get into. In fact, not one, but two different Russian intelligence agencies broke into the DNC. And as far as we can tell, each one didn't know the other one was there, which tells you they kind of operate the way we do. But they figured that somewhere in that trove of emails would be enough embarrassing data to just send the Hillary Clinton campaign into chaos. And we have to remember that Vladimir Putin had a particular problem with Hillary Clinton. And that was that when the 2012 elections were underway in Russia, she charged that the elections were fixed. And that led to some street protests in Moscow that most Americans don't remember. But Vladimir Putin remembers them. And he was determined when she was running for president that he was going to remind her in a very vivid way of the way she sort of held American democracy over to embarrass the Russians. And part of his goal here is not necessarily to elect Donald Trump or unelect Joe Biden or anything like that. It's to make us question the value of our own democracy. And he did a pretty good job of it, because when you think of it, the attacks in 2016 resulted in 4 years of investigation, and here we are days from an American presidential election, and we're still wondering what it is that the Russians may do in this election cycle.
What's fascinating, and I had even forgotten this, was how close, when WikiLeaks, when that drop comes, that's as the Democratic National Convention is beginning.
That's right. In the opening days of the convention, just hours before it started, they released a series of emails that made it clear that the DNC did, in fact, favor Hillary Clinton and send all the resources to her over Bernie Sanders, Vermont senator. And it basically proved what Sanders folks had been saying for some time. And ultimately, the chairwoman of the Democratic Party had to resign hours before the convention opened, throwing the convention into considerable chaos. But they weren't done at that moment.
They were not done. And as the White House, the Obama White House, becomes aware of this, I mean, the real conundrum is that if you do this, if you say it too loudly, are you trying to tip the race?
Well, they had two problems. One is, if you call out the Russians for doing this, are you amplifying their message that you can't control this? So there was some movement and some caution on part of President Obama and some of his advisors. Don't talk about it much because you'll be serving their purposes. And then the second concern seems kind of quaint under current circumstances, that Obama was saying, you know, I don't want to look to be putting my finger on the scale here. I mean, obviously he favored Hillary Clinton, but he didn't want to be going out giving speeches about the Russians supporting Trump that would seem to be spilling stuff. I'm not sure that President Trump would have a similar compunction, but but in any case, they didn't. And I think partly this was because they were convinced that Secretary Clinton was going to win and that they could deal with the Russians later.
So the intelligence community says, okay, we have concerns and we have to notify the public that this is happening.
Right.
So they go out and say, we're ready, here we go. And at almost the exact moment, the Access Hollywood tape drops.
That's right.
And guess what? Nobody cares about Russia anymore.
A bunch of things happened. So this was at about 3:30 in the afternoon on October 7th, 2016. It's seared in my memory. I was sitting in the New York Times newsroom in Washington, and we had had a little bit of warning that the director of national intelligence was going to announce that, in fact, they had concluded Russia was responsible and that Putin probably knew about it. We had already reported a few months before that that had been the intelligence conclusion, but here they were coming out and publicly announcing it. A half hour later, the Access Hollywood tape. And a half hour after that, WikiLeaks begins to dump out the John Podesta emails. All within the space of an hour. Now, that's a news day.
It is a news day. Obviously, a lot of that gets eclipsed, but in both in the documentary and in the book, you talk about your conversation with Donald Trump about cyber warfare and cyber attacks. That was as far as we got on how the nominee thought about the newest weapon that Russia and the United States were utilizing in a global struggle for power, quote, cyber is the future, his quote. But worse yet, he fueled our suspicion that at a minimum, he was perfectly comfortable with what was clearly Russian interference in the election, and he made us wonder whether wittingly or unwittingly, he had become Putin's agent of influence. It is the wittingly or unwittingly I want to ask you about now that we have 4 years under our belt.
Well, that turned out to be the beginning of a series of denials by the president, then the candidate, that Putin had been responsible for the attacks that we just described. It's an interesting argument to make because President Trump's own Justice Department has indicted 12 Russian officers of the GRU and members of the Internet Research Agency for this operation. And they've laid out in an indictment in great detail how they did it. And yet you hear the president come back and say, Russia, 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 it's a Russia hoax, and so forth. Sort of makes you wonder, well, if he believes this was all fabricated, shouldn't his Justice Department drop the charges against these poor, falsely accused Russian officers? They haven't done so yet. So there's this large divide even within the Trump administration between intelligence and justice officials, FBI officials, who have no doubt what the Russians did, and the president's imperative not to acknowledge this, because I think he believes, his own aides have said to me, that he believes that it impugns whether or not his election was legitimate. Now, I happen to believe he would have been elected had the Russians interfered or not. There's no way to prove the Russian interference resulted in his election.
Mm-hmm.
But it's very hard felt for him. Now, what's interesting is next week, if it's a close election, will he feel compelled to say that there was interference, not in 2016, but in 2020?
2017 is the first time that he meets, he goes face-to-face with Putin. They have the meeting in Hamburg. They go behind closed doors. The president calls you as he's headed toward, going toward Air Force One. Shortly after the summit broke up, you wrote, Trump headed for Air Force One and called me once he was in the air. He wanted to describe his first encounter with Putin. Most of Trump's call was off the record, but some of what he told me that afternoon, he repeated at various times in the next few days in talking about the session. He had raised the election hacking 3 times, he said, and Putin had denied involvement each time. But what was more remarkable, you write, was the explanation he gave. Trump had asked if he was involved in election meddling, he said. Putin denied it and said, if we did, we wouldn't have gotten caught because we're professionals. And he believed that.
More importantly, the president said to me, David, you write about this stuff. Don't you believe that? They wouldn't have been caught, right? And I said to him, you know, Mr. President, you've seen all the intelligence reports here. And he said, yeah, but they all came from Clapper and Comey and Brennan, all of the Obama-era intelligence officials. He said, they're all political people. I can't believe any of that. It was a pretty remarkable moment. He was basically saying, I'm going to believe Vladimir Putin over the American intelligence establishment.
So, as you just alluded to, the question that will come next week, if the president does indeed lose, is what is the level of Russian interference? But we're going to talk about that regardless, right? I mean, you mentioned the hospitals of what is happening as we record this interview. So this is happening. One of the things I just want to back up before we talk about that, and I thought it was really interesting because you touch on it toward the end of the documentary, which is the Iowa caucuses. So just because there was a meltdown, was that interference or not? Part of this game is that you can assume that because there's chaos.
So in the Iowa caucuses, you may remember people put together, well-intentioned people, a new app so that you
right.
could caucus even if there were snowstorms keeping people away. And the thing hadn't been tested out well. It was like getting a bad app on your phone, right? And
we've all had
it basically fell apart during the first use in Iowa. And you'll see this in the film. But the Russians had nothing to do with it. You know, this was just a plain old mistake. But of course, as soon as it went bad, everyone's first thought was, this must be the Russians. And just the fact that we had that perception tells you how deeply ingrained this is. And you know, Joe, it happened again last week in Virginia. It was the last day to register to vote.
Right.
And people were trying to register online. And someone with a backhoe mistakenly went through the telecommunications line that links the Virginia Secretary of State Registration Office to the rest of the world. And for 4 hours, you couldn't get online. And everybody's initial thought was, someone's messing with this. Well, no one was messing with this.
It's what you call in the documentary a perception attack.
That's right.
Our mind asks if it's the Russians, and it doesn't matter whether it is or not because we're asking the question.
That's right. And we lose confidence in our system.
Okay. So that was 300 years ago in February of this year. And then in March comes the global pandemic, which again gives an opportunity for things to be impacted by cyber.
Boy, a bunch of new opportunities. First of all, the Chinese target turns away from, you know, collecting the secrets of building stealth aircraft to the secrets of putting a vaccine together. We're all working from home, creating a range of new vulnerabilities. I've got neighbors in Washington who work for the intelligence agencies. Well, they can't work from home easily because they don't have classified systems coming into their houses. And while some are going into work, you know what happens. More and more people find outside channels to get work done that they normally would do over classified systems.
Right.
More and more businesses are operating over systems they never thought about securing, whether they're newspapers or law firms or manufacturers or whatever. So it accelerated what's been happening in the cyber world anyway, which is an increase in the attack surface. And just imagine what was in your own home 10 years ago. You know, maybe you had a desktop computer connected to the internet. Now your TVs are connected to the internet, your refrigerator's connected,
right.
Your Fitbit's connected, the car right. outside's connected. And every one of those is a convenience, and every one of those opens up the attack surface.
2 points that I want to talk about before we try to figure out what's going to happen next week. But so you say in the documentary, coronavirus has reordered the competition for world power. And so not surprisingly, it reordered cyber power as well. Talk a little bit about that. And also, I'm interested in you talking about, which is something that is brought up several times in the documentary, about Russia's use of the Ukraine as a petri dish, because we saw that at the beginning of the coronavirus.
So Ukraine has been Russia's petri dish. It's where it tested out messing with elections, presidential elections. It's where it tested out turning off the power in electric utilities. It used all kinds of information warfare around the spread of COVID. But the real reordering has come from China's effort to go steal COVID research. Now, they're doing some very good COVID vaccine research of their own. But the Chinese recognize that whatever country really comes up with a vaccine first and can spread it around the rest of the world is going to have enormous soft power around the rest of the world. If the Chinese can be the first one to show up in NATO countries and say, those Americans, they're going to be sticking the vaccine into the arms of Americans first.
This is the Holy Grail.
This is it.
So 5G comes into this as well.
5G does, because this all happens at a moment when the Chinese are using the opportunity to go spread new networks throughout the world, the 5G, fifth generation networks, which is really a rewiring of the innards of the internet. And while 5G, you know, we all think about it in terms of our phones, in fact, its real import is enabling you over cellular connections to operate factories, to operate autonomous vehicles. In other words, to work at speeds that right now you can only work at if you're someplace that's got internet service in the building. And they've recognized that if they can lay this cable around the world, if they can build the switches around the world, mm-hmm. if they can do the software around the world's communications will flow through their networks the way they flowed through America's since Alexander Graham Bell's time.
You make the point that they are exploiting the chasms that are already present in the United States. How do you think, or, I mean, the obvious question, of course, as many of us have already gone to the polls, but for the people who are going to the polls, and even for votes that have already been cast, how safe are they?
I'm not that worried about the voting machines. I am worried about the registration system, because the registration systems are vulnerable. Just on Monday, the governor of Florida showed up to vote early. Mm-hmm. And what did he discover? That his address had been changed from Tallahassee to West Palm Beach. Now, the police just arrested a young hacker who was going in to do this either as a political statement or a prank. But if it was that easy to get into the registration system and change the governor's address for him, imagine how easy it would be for the Iranians or the North Koreans or even the Junior League hackers team in Russia.
So what impact could it have, question one, question two, and when do we become aware of it?
Numerically, I don't think it's going to have much impact. You mentioned before the concept of a perception hack.
Yes.
If you can get into the registration systems of just a few towns and cities in Wisconsin or Minnesota or Pennsylvania or Florida, you name the battleground state, you could create the impression that you're in the system throughout the state. Now, the president's already said this election will be rigged. He's been quite clear about that. He has said if he does not win, it's only because someone rigged it against him. So if his incentive in 2016 was to say there was no interference, I think he's probably a bit predisposed now, just looking at his Twitter feed, to suggest that there may be interference. And this time next week, if it's a close election, you could well see him making that argument. If it's not a close election, then I think it's a much tougher argument to make.
And it could still happen, but it's a tougher argument.
That's right. And also, I don't think anybody was anticipating that we would have this much early voting and this much mail-in voting. And while I know the president says mail-in voting leads to fraud, it also creates a paper trail. So we can figure out, even if there is hacking, what the intent was of most voters.
Do you feel, just having been a reporter for so long, Is there a sense of dread looking at next week, thinking, oh, God?
You know, Joe, you've been in this business for a long time. The citizen in me might say a bit of dread. The journalist in me says, we're going to learn a lot about how the system's evolved. And that's really why I wanted the Perfect Weapon documentary to come out before the election, so that we're all thinking about these hacks of the infrastructure and these hacks of the mind.
Is there anything we can do about it?
There is, to some degree. You know, you have locks on your front doors and alarm systems and so forth, and that's to eliminate 85% of, like, the walk-by, drive-by crime in the neighborhood, right? And that's what basic cybersecurity is about. It's why you don't use the same password for everything. It's why you pay attention to what you're clicking on when you get that spear phishing email. But we also have to recognize that those locks on the doors do not protect you from an incoming missile. That we're leaving for the government. And the big question for cyber is, where is that line between our own responsibility or our company's or our employer's responsibility to protect us? Where does that end and the government begin? And we're just now really still struggling with that question as a nation.
The name of the book, the name of the documentary, The Perfect Weapon. David Sanger, a great pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so much for spending the time with us.
Great to be with you, Joe.
The HBO documentary, The Perfect Weapon, is playing and streaming now on HBO. The book that it is based on is The Perfect Weapon, War, Sabotage, and Fear in the Cyber Age. My thanks to the folks at Bennington College and especially College President Laura Walker for making this all possible. Thanks also to the crew at The Brick House and to Sarah LeDuc for her producing and engineering work. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.